Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Well, it's a new year and the beginning of another award season. As I record this, we're waiting anxiously for the results of the Oscar Bake Off, where seven films get narrowed down to three for the actual nomination. The BAFTA nominees, British Film Awards, have been announced. The Visual Effects Society nominees came out. And one of those films, nominated for Visual Effects Society Outstanding Supporting Visual Effects Award, is Valkyrie. And we're going to speak today with Richard Hoover, who is the visual effects supervisor on that film. Before we get to that interview, I wanted to take a second to talk about something special we're doing over this term on FX PhD. In addition to our training we've offered, we've also tried over the years to give you footage to be used for your own demo reel and actual practical involvement. In fact, last year at this time, we were at Sundance, where two of our films, short films that we had worked on and co-produced even, were in the competition, which was quite the amazing achievement. So some work done by students was actually shown at Sundance in these films that were released last year. This term, we're doing something special. This is not a course. It's a project called Special Ops 402. And this is a real project where you work with Mike and John on an actual job where you'll get actual credit on a major project. It's a complete non-disclosure project. You need to apply. The entry is not open to everyone. And it's neither costs more or pays anything. But it's a chance to do real work on a real project. So check it out. You have to be a member of FX PhD to even participate in this, and it should be an interesting project. So anyway, this is just something really special we're doing this term over at FX PhD. So if you're a member, check out the threads and in the forums, and you'll find a thread on special ops. Let's go now to the interview Mike Seymour did with Richard Hoover about the film Valkyrie.
The army swore an oath that won't just die with Hitler.
Doesn't matter. It only matters that we act now, before we lose the war. Otherwise, this will always be Hitler's Germany. And we have to show the world that not all of us were like him.
That is not enough for me. There has to be a chance of success.
My Führer, may I present Colonel Stauffenberg?
So thank you so much for joining us. We do appreciate it.
Of course. Like to do it.
So this is a really interesting film because in many respects, and I believe Bryan Singer himself said this, that there's sort of two ways you could have looked at a film like this. It could be a cross between Unusual Suspects and Born on the 4th of July, or Mission Impossible crossed with Superman. In other words, it could be huge, big budget, you know, megastar thing, or a more thoughtful, independent-y, smaller budget film. Where does the film kind of end up for you?
I'd say the latter, probably a more thoughtful, independent film. It obviously has big stars in it and very big production value.
And so I term
the Superman connotation to be, and Mission Impossible to be, more of an action-based story than almost a documentary-based story.
Well, I think it's interesting, although there have been German language accounts of this story, I think it's going to be interesting for the English-speaking world to see a film version that tells us about Stauffenberg, who was a hero to the German people, Tresco, and other people involved in this story, who were definitely part of a significant resistance movement that does tell us that not every member of the German army was a Nazi or a member of the National Socialist Party, and that there was a separate German military tradition, you know, that was in some ways very intellectual, very academic, and that, you know, philosophically, intellectually disagreed with Hitler. And although their voices were often suppressed, they were there, and they were vocal, and they were heard, if not loudly, in the latter part, particularly of the Second World War. And I think that this film is a very interesting realization of that secret part of the war. There was resistance in Germany, and this film tells you a little about what it was.
Because it is a true story, and that adds a huge amount of weight to your role with visual effects, because there's both a need for tremendous sensitivity, but also this is a period that, there's actual film of the period. We know what it looked like.
Absolutely, and that's what made the film so fun for me, was it was almost like going back to college. You were reading the history, you could read about the characters. There were a lot of historical photographs of both the characters and the places the events took place in. And the filmmakers went through an extraordinary effort to try to shoot as much of the story in either the actual places that it took place in or something almost identical to it. So that made it that much more real, I think, for everybody who was on the film working on it. That, you contemplate that mentally when you're there. They were actually here. They were doing this that we're shooting right here. And it made it really fun to think about and to be involved in.
So notwithstanding the sensitivities to anything dealing with the Second World War and, of course, Nazi Germany, there's also a real sense that anything of this period, people feel very passionate about. I mean, in terms of accuracy now I'm talking, people really, understand and take a big interest in this period, and obviously.
Okay.
In terms of doing the visual effects, you're not primarily producing a documentary to show exactly what this or that looked like. You're trying to produce a dramatic film, and yet people are very aware of the accuracy nature of it. So from the bombing raids in Northern Africa and stuff, was there a line there between, well, that works dramatically, and, that sort of isn't how it may have actually been?
I think both came into play. And Chris McCrory, the writer, of course, were very concerned with producing an accurate film, historically accurate film. And so we started with that. We started with the homework and the research, from what places did these events occur, what did they look like, what kind of photographic history can we find. Chris did a lot of interviews, and I think so did Brian, with people of the era and people that knew Stauffenberg or people who knew of the events to acquire as much information as they could about what really happened and what people's moods or attitudes were about this kind of thing. And I, as a visual effects supervisor, did a lot of homework about what the environments looked like in 1943 when this took place, and what Stauffenberg's injuries, or at least people with similar injuries, looked like, what kind of surgical procedures were used both in the field and in the hospital. What did the, what did the scars look like? How did they heal? All those kind of things. And there was an amazing amount of research done to try to make it as authentic and real as possible. Now, having said that, Brian and I would discuss, in scene by scene almost, what was appropriate for the audience to see, and always keeping an eye, a wary eye on, making the story be the most important thing and not the Stauffenberg scars or his injuries or whatever. They were just part of his character. From the beginning, we talked about how Tom Cruise would behave or use these his injuries, the loss of his hand or his missing fingers. And there was there were several accounts that Stauffenberg was not subconscious about his injuries. He accepted them fully and behaved very normally about them, and expected everyone around him just to accept that that's what he looked like and that's was part of him.
So just to set that up for people,
weren't hiding it.
So he was in North Africa with the Panzer Division, and in April 43, there's the incident that caused him to lose his eye, his right hand, and his fourth and fifth fingers on his left hand. Is that right?
Correct.
We can serve Germany with a few, not both.
It's just that sort of talk that has you sent here, Colonel.
What I said was much worse.
I'm just trying to get these men out of here alive. See that he's done.
Thank you. Africa when his column was attacked by British Spitfires. He lost his right hand, two fingers on his left hand, and his left eye.
You came to us as a wounded soldier. Now you're the architect and the assassin.
That does totally play to the actual plot of the assassination attempt, because he had to have a certain amount of dexterity to actually work with the pencil detonator and the bomb and stuff. So clearly, exactly. Going in, you must have known that the amputee nature of some of his injuries would figure prominently. What was the strategy for dealing with that, just at a technical level?
Well, I think Brian really looked at what needed to be happening and knew that there were, you know, there's sort of some documented facts about the explosives themselves and the tools and the special pliers that were made that he could hold in his hands. So, I mean, there was no eyewitness left alive to say, yeah, this is what we did. But he made an interpretation that I thought was very plausible, how he may handle this. And the fact that he used his attaché to help him, you know, manage with the weaponry and the tools and getting it built and armed in an appropriate manner, I think seems very reasonable. I mean, they did find the bomb that they had with them that they didn't use. They did find the pliers. The Germans are so accurate in their documentation. There was a full report where they scoured the road from the Wolf's Lair to the airstrip and found these things. And so I think there was quite a bit of facts that went into what you see in the film and that interpretation of how he got the weapons ready.
Right, because he had two bombs and he only had time to arm the one, and then the other was discarded when he left the bunker. So
correct. I mean, we know that he had two with him. We know that only one was used. We really don't know what happened that didn't allow him to arm both.
But from a visual effects point of view, how did you produce Tom Cruise without hands and fingers?
Well, we photographed Tom's hand very carefully and measured his hand. He had had a cast of his hand made for prosthetics, both of the stump of his right hand and for some prosthetic approaches at how to show his missing digits on his left hand. We found that the prosthetics made his fingers look a little fat, and there wasn't any photographic reference of those types of injuries that supported that swelling or change in dimension of the digits. So I ended up trying some green screen sleeves on the fingers and different ways of outlining where the fingers would be missing, but they had as many negative properties that the green sleeves would cast green spill all over the other parts of the hands that we wanted to keep, and I didn't want to just replace the hand. I wanted to keep as much of the real photographed hand as absolutely possible. So I ended up going with working with Tom's makeup artist, Sarah, and coming up with a makeup that was the same color as his skin when in shadow. And I had her paint lines on each finger pretty much every day at a point that we agreed upon on a certain crease in his skin that would allow the artist later in post-production to see exactly where the fingers should be removed in a very consistent manner. And the fact that it was shadow color meant that we could use that shadowing of the skin color as part of our process if we wanted to.
And so then it was just a digital removal?
Yeah, we made a digital copy, right, of his hand using these measurements and photographs. And a scan of the cast from the mold of his hand. And then we photographically lined those up together and modified that until it fit perfectly. And then we tracked, you know, frame by frame, everything he did on every shot in 3D, and then modeled and lit the fingers to match the lighting and the skin quality on every shot. And then very painstakingly just use as little of the digital hand as we could to make that illusion successful. You know, most of it had to do with rebuilding the palm, because most of the time, Tom would bend those two fingers down toward his palm, and that's also what looked most natural in the way, you know, if he had to pick up a phone, otherwise, the way he held his hand to pick up a phone looked unnatural. But
right.
Much more natural to have them bent down. And when we would talk about it, say, well, how would you do this if you didn't have those digits? You just can't do anything that you use them. You can't touch fabric. You can't move things on the table when he's building the bomb with those digits because they're not really there. That kind of thing. So I would watch it shot, but Tom was really terrific at doing it. He got it within a few days of shooting. He handled himself very naturally. In fact, there was one scene in the very beginning in Africa where he's signing in his notebook. He's writing in his notebook about his thoughts about the war and Hitler and the travesties that are going on, and he's writing with his left hand, and he's not left-handed, and he's writing in German. So he's extremely athletic and
wow.
Dexterous with his ability. I was very surprised how well he did.
So does the film start the story in 43? Because it was only between 43 when he had the accident and 14 months later, the plot happened on the 20th of July. When does the film pick up the story?
Well, I think the way the film is introduced, it starts with Africa, and it starts with him getting injured, and then you find him in the hospital recovering. And it just goes from there. I don't know, you know, precisely how linearly the film is or how accurately linearly the film is to that date, but I know that they talked about it a lot and tried to maintain that accuracy as much as possible.
By nightfall, I want to know that Hitler's Germany has seen its last sunrise.
The reason that everyone is here is because Brian Singer is involved. Everyone, including myself, admires him tremendously. He's an important filmmaker.
I think my interest in the Second World War began when I was very young. You know, I was a Jewish kid who was studying the Holocaust in high school. We had an in-depth class on the Holocaust, actually. And I think from there, that the notion of the Third Reich and the impact it had on the world stayed with me up until I made a film, Apt Pupil, which dealt with the subject matter. And also, I touched upon it in the first X-Men picture. And I think it just continues to be interesting. It's one of the most provocative times in history. I think Hitler is one of the most extraordinary and terrifying characters in human history, and one that exists by his own will on film. You can look back. It's the one history. It's the one monumental terror, one of the great regimes that you can see captured so extraordinarily by his own cameras.
And away from the actual work with Tom Cruise, there was, you know, obviously a lot of other aspects of any historical drama that need to be taken into account. Starting with the North African stuff, what was the... I believe there was heavy previs done by Third Floor, is that right?
Yeah, we did. We did some previs. A lot at the very beginning of the film, that the sequence was much, much larger than it is in the film now. When we started, and there's as I understand it, I couldn't be totally accurate on this, but as I understand it, there's just some fairly sketchy information about exactly where it occurred. They know it was in North Africa. They know it was Panzer Division, but I guess there were some various accounts as to where exactly they were when this happened. Other than they were on some sort of road when they were attacked by air. So we did our best to recreate that situation, and had more to do with, you know, a little filling in of the backstory about how Stauffenberg got to North Africa. I think that's probably, anyone who's really a historian buff and really interested in this kind of history would probably do themselves a favor to read further about Stauffenberg himself and his life and what led him up to, making this decision and trying to preserve Germany and, you know, their place in the world, which is what they were trying to do, I think, before the Allies invaded and millions of Europeans got killed. So it was a noble cause. It really was. That's what makes it a great story. But there was a lot of previs and forethought into how to plan out that scene and how it would support, you know, because that scene is as much about showing him injured as it is about telling the audience his point of view of the war and how the German military is being run and how decisions are being made and where it's taking, you know, Germany. And that was, you know, kind of difficult to do very succinctly in one scene. And that's why I think we went around and around on it quite a bit till we settled on what we have.
And to just pull that off visually, were there any actual aircraft, or was it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we had a real P-40s in that scene and real German tanks and vehicles and, great uniforms. As much that could be done realistically was done. Even in the German near field thing, the Russian front fields by the Wolfslayer, we had real Yonkers and Messerschmitts. Now, we augmented them here and there. In some cases, we cut out the real planes and did new moves on them or retracked them to show more planes. Sometimes we added CG planes. But it was only the CG was the last resort, not the intended design. Intended design was to shoot as much real as possible.
And then in sort of the rest of the film, there must have been a reasonable amount of work to do either set extensions or to remove modern-day life to bring those actual historical locations into the correct period. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We did all the above, and there were a variety of techniques. Some were just 2D matte painting extensions. Some were 2.5D extensions. Some were just paint outs of modern day things, as you said. And in the case of the Wolfslayer, we built Hitler's retreat fully digital, based on again historic photographs and the textures and materials that they used then. Hitler's retreat went through quite a metamorphosis from the time he bought it till 1943, and even beyond that, it kept changing and growing. And so there's quite a bit of photographs of it and him with different officers and his wife, etc., up there, that allowed us to build something I think is very accurate to the times. And in Germany, there are a lot of these buildings still exist that were part of the German infrastructure during the war, as well as key architectural buildings at the time. You know, the airport is there, and the Lufthansa building that we used as the finest part of the one of the headquarters buildings. And the German, I don't know if it was the city government or who exactly was in charge of it, but there were telephone poles and light poles and traffic lights and signs and they were very cooperative in having all those taken down and removed for, you know, brief periods of time, like over a weekend. So that pretty much all we had to do was paint out things that were very permanently bolted down that they couldn't remove. So it wasn't as much work as I thought I was going to have to do.
Yeah, and that's a really extraordinary level of cooperation to sort of remove all that stuff.
Yeah, and on either side of these key buildings, we would... we acquired historical photographs of those streets and what buildings were actually there at that time. And we did try to follow what was there as closely as we could. There was some dramatic license there, but for the most part, it was the right architecture and the right layout, et cetera, that was really there at that time. And hopefully people watch the movie, they really have no idea what was real and what wasn't. And, they'll watch the story and enjoy the story.
I swore an oath, and an oath that won't just die with Hitler.
Doesn't matter. It only matters that we act now, before we lose the war. Otherwise, this will always be Hitler's Germany. And we have to show the world that not all of us were like him.
That is not enough for me. There has to be a chance of success.
Then find a way.
Yeah, I mean, it is a gripping story, and it is easy to paint German soldiers of that time as all being sort of Gestapo or SS, whereas, in fact, the colonel wasn't even a member of the Nazi Party, was he? He was.
You know, that I think that's one of the most interesting things that I learned in being involved in the film, and even myself being kind of a war film buff. I love to watch World War II films. There've been a lot of films that I enjoy, and to see the basic connotation that all German soldiers are Nazis, and that kind of generalized look at the soldiers or the military, the Germans, and the fact that that's not true at all, that there's this political party of soldiers of the Nazis, and then there's the German military. And they weren't always on the same page, for sure. And to some degree, that's what the movie's about. I mean, learning that and how their opinions of what they were trying to do, it could be rather different.
Yeah. So tell me, how many shots did it, was the sort of shot count you ended up with to produce this high treason?
Well, we worked on a little over 600 shots in the film, which is roughly half, but not all of them are in the movie.
Right.
I don't remember exactly how many of those fell on the editing room floor, but, you know, there's definitely over 500 probably still in the film.
And just in terms of pipeline, was this a sort of a fairly traditional pipeline that you would have used on any of your earlier films? Because, I mean, you know...
Absolutely. You know, this was a film about reusing existing technology, existing methods that we had used in other films. You know, our skin shader, and for example, was something that we developed through, Beowulf, Spider-Man, and Superman, for reproducing, you know, photorealistic human beings. And, things, our pipeline for tracking in particular was fairly ready to deal with this problem. And, matte painting, et cetera. We did hire Robert Stromberg to do one matte painting on the church, which is a scene where Bill Nye's character is talking to Tom Cruise's character and trying to convince him to join this group to carry out this mission. And it's based on a church that's still a monument in the middle of Germany there, where the roof was blown off in a bombing raid, but the walls of the church still existed. And we had photographic reference of them having candlelight service in that church with the roof removed. And that's where this idea came from. So although we shot in a church in Pasadena and we removed the roof digitally and through matte painting, it was really based on that German church. But it's very traditional shooting. No bells and whistles. We're not breaking new technology here with visual effects.
Using
the technique that's best suited for this kind of movie and making it seamless and invisible as possible.
But as we said, sort of crafted with both an eye to historical accuracy and, of course, sensitivity to the material at hand.
I'm a soldier, but in serving my country, I have betrayed my conscience.
I really do appreciate you taking time to talk to us. Thank you so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we do have a new term over at FX PhD. There's 15 new courses out of like 37 total courses. So if you're looking to get into the industry or just expand your skill set, check it out. I think you'll find it's the best value for the money out there. So for Mike Seymour, John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.